The voices of two men, two former generals, 175 years apart. President George Washington.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual ways of preserving peace.
And Secretary of Defense George Marshall.
Today, no voice is listened to in our troubled world unless it has adequate steel to support it.
Living 1951 spans today more than a century and a half of American military history, from the Revolution to Korea. To light up the route by which we have now come to the point where universe has at last become a matter for decision in our Congress, we call our drama document
Toward a Nation in Arms.
Your narrator, Ben Grauer.
Greetings, America. This week, on Capitol Hill in Washington, your elected representatives have been mulling and debating the provisions of a bill which is without precedent in our story as a people. We have a draft, even though we are not officially at war. And now, military training of our youth in peacetime as a regular part of the American way of life has been proposed for the first time in our history. How, we ask ourselves, has this come about? Why do we, the most peace-loving of all nations, with all our moral scruples, our tradition of protest against militarism and war, how do we yet find ourselves debating the issue of UMT, Universal Military Training? For a perspective on this urgent question, America, for an attempt to answer to ourselves how we seem to have arrived at this point in living 1951, we begin our story 175 years ago on the western shores of Europe. Come with us now to the turbulent days of the French Revolution, to the France, storming the palaces in their redingotes, caps of pelt, cotton stockings and wooden shoes.
Liberté! Égalité! Fraternité!
These men, though they didn't know it at the time, were giving expression to the forces that were shaping the rise of the modern democratic state. For here in the fires of this revolutionary spirit were being consumed the age-old feudal allegiances to lord and manor, to local tyrant and local town. And out of the ashes, stirred by the breezes of this new age of personal freedom and the importance of the individual, was springing a new loyalty.
Vive la France! Vive la France! Vive la France!
Loyalty not to a man, not to a plot of ground, but to a flag, a nation. And once this new loyalty was recognized, hand in hand with it came the recognition of new obligations.
You are at a critical session of the French deputies, the year 1792. The infant republic is surrounded by ancient monarchies that threaten to engulf her. Danger hovers along every boundary. The chairman in the French Chamber of Deputies lifts his gavel.
And now, I invite the attention of all the deputies to the reading of the bill. Voici.
All citizens are indebted to liberty. Some owe it their labor, others their fortune. All owe it the blood which flows in their veins.
Read it again. Again. Let it be heard again. Read it again.
So moved are the deputies by this inspiring sentiment, they cheer and urge that it be read again. This the reader does and continues.
Therefore, the Committee on Public Safety issues the following decree to all Frenchmen. The young men shall fight. The married men shall forge weapons. The women will make tents and serve in hospitals. The children will make up old linen into lint. The old men will rouse the courage of the fighting men and preach hatred of kings and the unity of the Republic.
This, America, was conscription, a principle later incorporated into the French Constitution, entitling the government to the service of every able-bodied citizen between the ages of 20 and 25. Thus, France became the first great power in terms of the mobilized strength of its citizen soldiers. And thus, this line in the Marseillaise.
Arise, ye sons of France.
Yes, arise, ye sons of France is no poet's conceit, but is quite literally a call to arms to every patriot of a citizen army. This then was universal military service in the First Republic of France, a national answer to a danger that threatened on the national doorstep. But you say, what about our own American Revolution, which had surged out of the same wellsprings of freedom only a few years before? Wasn't the American Revolution won by a citizen's army? Suppose we examine and compare.
The year 1775, Washington has just taken command of the Continental Army, made up of militia units, indifferently disciplined, and drawn from 13 separate colonies, each jealous of its own right to independent action. Independence meant to Virginia, independence for Virginia. To Rhode Island, independence for Rhode Island. A united, commonly responsible nation did not yet exist, and there was yet no public sentiment which said a man should serve his country.
But let's get the story in the words of Washington himself as revealed in his letter. September 1775, 3 months after assuming command.
My situation is inexpressibly distressing. To see the winter approaching upon a naked army, the time of their service within a few weeks expiring, and no provision made for such important events. The greater part of the troops are not far from mutiny.
A month later,
to the President of Congress, sir, the number enlisted since my last is 2,540. Instead of pressing to be engaged in the cause of their country, which I vainly flattered myself would be the case, I find we are likely to be deserted in a most critical time. Our situation is truly alarming.
In 1777, as Washington watches his militia force melt away,
to Thomas Wharton, President of Pennsylvania. I assure you, sir, it is a matter of astonishment to every part of the continent to hear that Pennsylvania, the most opulent and populous of all the states, has but 1,200 militia in the field.
As Washington struggles on, forced to build a new army every year, very often after every campaign, only to see it dissolve again, Congress finally sends a committee to placate him.
Patience, General, patience.
Patience.
You must understand our position. The Continental Congress can, as it has done, authorize a regular force, but we cannot compel the colonies to recruit for it. We can merely recommend.
Yes, General, you must understand our position.
Your position? Gentlemen, there is only one position, and that's the position our army holds. If we lose that, we lose everything.
But, General...
Pray, please, preserve me from the butts. During the past summer months, never had I more than 16,000 soldiers. Raw, untrained, undisciplined soldiers. Before Trenton, these dwindled to 5,000. And believe this, there have been times when I could not muster 3,000 for the field.
General, you see,
bear these words from me, gentlemen, if you will, back the road you came. Such a dearth of public spirit and want of virtue. Such stock-jobbing and fertility in all the low arts to obtain advantages of one kind or another, I never saw before, and pray God I may never witness again. Indeed, such a dirty, mercenary spirit pervades the whole that I should not be surprised at any disaster that may happen.
Congress answered Washington not by extending the period of enlistment, but by baiting its recruiting posters with a free premium offer.
See here, Jonathan, what the new poster says. For every man who hath an inclination to join the troops now raising under General Washington...
Aye?
$200, a suit of clothes each year, and 100 acres of land.
Aye, a man could wed with that.
And so the American Revolution dragged on for 7 weary years. And no one would deny that haphazard methods of recruitment was a factor in prolonging it. The Continental Volunteers were brave enough when called on to prove their mettle at Saratoga and Valley Forge. But with all the bonuses and enticements, they were just as likely to throw down their muskets and go trudging home come plowing time. One historian was perhaps less than charitable, but not altogether inaccurate when he said...
It was not the American volunteer army so much as the fortitude of Washington, French aid, British blundering, and distance that brought victory to the American cause.
Yes, distance. Swapping time for distance. We learned the trick in the Revolution. We were to use it again. Well, when it was all over and freedom seemed secure... The American conscience, which rebels at militarism, spoke out in the infant Congress.
And whereas standing armies in time of peace are inconsistent with the principles of republican governments, dangerous to the liberties of a free people, and generally converted into destructive engines for establishing despotism, it is therefore resolved by the Congress of the Confederation that the commanding officer be, and he is hereby directed, to discharge the troops now in service of the United States. Except 25 privates to guard the stores of Fort Pitt and 55 to guard the stores at West Point.
Yes, deep grained in our tradition as a people is this instinctive resistance to the notion of a large military establishment in time of peace. And even when the cannon boomed again in the War of 1812, the proposal of a draft, they called it conscription then, brought a torrent of angry rhetoric from the youthful Daniel Webster.
Conscription? To propose conscription is to deny the blood of patriots that flows in our veins. For the embattled farmer, as he has in the past, will rise in righteous wrath without the shackles of force to defy those who will take what God has given him as his own. Conscription? Call it by its rightful name, contradiction, absurdity, and the abomination of democracy.
But if, as Webster said, conscription was an abomination, its alternative, reliance on the volunteer militia, was frustration and near disaster. Here's what one military expert has to say about that in the War of 1812.
Great Britain never put into the field more than 16,500 troops.
And we used...
We used, or rather failed to use effectively, a total of 527,000 men. 33 times as many.
Yes, the American militiaman of the War of 1812 was a dead shot with a squirrel gun, as Jackson and his boys proved so memorably at New Orleans. But all too often, when it came to military discipline, was a rugged individualist.
Now listen to me, lads. What does the Constitution say? I ask you, bold now. What does the Constitution say?
The Constitution says we got to fight to defend our country.
Defend. Examine that word, lads. Defend. But does it say, does it, that the government has a right to order us to attack? I say to you, no, lads, it does not. Therefore, I stand on my constitutional rights, I do. I'll defend my country, aye. But I, for one, won't attack tomorrow because nobody's got a right to order me to do it. And if you've the sense you were born with, you won't either.
Nor were those American militiamen always so expert in defense. That was the war, you'll recall, when Dolly Madison hastily fled north from Washington in the wake of some 4,000 of her retreating countrymen, and the British marched in and burned the White House. Throughout our history, Americans have been a peaceful people, inclined to regard their military service as an unpleasant chore. An interlude to be sandwiched between the normal and more important pursuits of farming and commerce. General Winfield Scott found that out in our war with Mexico.
Well, now I think if we keep after Santa Anna...
Excuse me, sir. Lieutenant Hastings is waiting to see you, sir.
Well, what does he want?
He didn't say, sir, except it was important.
All right, have him in.
Yes, sir.
Now, as I was saying, we've got Santa Anna on the run, and... yes, Lieutenant?
Lieutenant Hastings reporting, sir.
Well, what is it? What is it? And make it brief.
General Scott, you asked me to check on the enlistment terms of the men.
Oh, yes, yes, but can't that wait?
No, sir. Well, you see, sir, by the first of the month, 40,000 troops will have completed their one-year enlistment terms and can return home.
What?
Well, it's true, sir. The figures are all here.
But we've got Santa Anna beaten now. If we let him get away, the rascal will have time to recover and organize again.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm only stating the facts. The men say they're going home, and they're within their rights, sir.
Fire and brimstone. Now we'll have to sit down and wait for reinforcements.
Thus, at the height of his march to Mexico City, General Scott, because of the nation's short-term enlistment policy, had to halt his advance, thus prolonging the war while he waited for replacements for 50% of his army. And thus, America, we came to the great ordeal, the war between the states. And we came still innocent of any firm precedent about the use of manpower in time of conflict. When the sound of the cannons firing on Fort Sumter shattered the April air, we did in fact have a regular army, 16,000 of them, but stationed for the most part on our western frontier. In Washington, officials reluctantly took stock.
What shall we do?
Send out a call for 75,000 militia men to serve 3 months.
3 months? Why, that's scarcely enough time to train them, let alone use them to any advantage in the field.
Well, what can we do? You know how the public feels about long enlistments.
Not until 3 months after Sumter does Congress convene, and then merely authorizes President Lincoln to accept the services of volunteers. 60-day wonders this time. In vain, Lincoln tries later through an executive order to levy the states for 300,000 troops. Finally...
Mr. President, there's no avoiding it. All our old devices have failed, and the South is on the march.
Yes, I know.
Well, there's only one way to get the troops we need. Raise them by conscription, by draft.
Then let it be done, and may God help us.
Well, it's down right here in the newspaper by Christopher in plain black and white.
Read it, read it.
All able-bodied citizens between the ages of 20 and 45.
That's me.
Me too. Shh. Constitute the national forces and shall be liable to perform military duty in the service of the United States when called out by the president.
All I got to say is, I should have voted for John S. Breckinridge.
Unpopular is a mild word to use for the first draft the nation ever knew.
The federal draft, applied without taking local governments into partnership, fell only upon the states that failed to fill their quotas with volunteers. There were manhunts for evaders and delinquents. But perhaps the feature which made it most unpopular...
Thank you, sir.
But I want
you... Oh, I'll take you at your word. Now, wait a minute. Let me make out a paper showing that you've purchased outright exemption from the draft. After all, it's your right.
Yes, if you paid $300, you were free from the draft. But if you didn't have $300, there was another way out.
John? John, as you've eyes to see for yourself, I have more hands working the farm now than I can use. Now, you're getting on in years, but you're a strong man. I'll make a bargain with you.
A bargain, Mr. Turner?
Yep. If you fight in the army in my stead, that piece of land you've been admiring south of the fork... Well, after you come back, I wouldn't be surprised you owned it free and clear.
Lacking $300, all you had to do was find a substitute. And so wealthy districts filled their quotas from poor districts, offering lavish bounties for such substitutes. And a few dishonest men discovered a new profession.
It's simple, Thomas. All you need to do is sell yourself as a substitute, see?
Well, then what?
The moment you collect your bounty, desert to another district.
Yes?
And sell your services again. Do that over and over like I've been doing, and by the time the war's done, you'll be as wealthy as Abner Tatum.
But in spite of bounty jumpers and paid substitutes and riots and corruption, there was an army. There were bravery and honor on both sides. And at length, two men came to Appomattox. The Union was preserved. And Johnny went marching home again. Johnny, who for the first time in American history and in the modern sense of the term, had been a drafted soldier.
Secretary of War Baker is now being blindfolded. There, done. Now being led to the glass bowl filled with the capsules containing the numbers of the 10 million men who have registered for the draft. He puts his hand in. He pulls out the first number. It is...
258.
The number is 258.
That America is a ceremony which took place in 1917, soon after our entry into World War I. It came 2.5 years after the battle had been joined in Europe, years in which we, on this side of the Atlantic, again behind our moat of time and distance, could sit and watch and think. And during those years, we thought many things.
President Wilson, my editor wants me to ask you how you feel about conscription as opposed to volunteering.
Gentlemen, I have been asked by questioning friends whether I thought a sufficient number of men would volunteer for the training or not.
What is your opinion, Mr. President?
Why, if they did not, it is not the America that you and I know. Something has happened. If they did not do it, I should be ashamed of America.
But as time wore on, even idealistic President Wilson came to the view that the plight of England, as it clung stubbornly to the notion that modern war could be fought with volunteers, was a plain signpost on the path not to be trod. England finally turned to the draft, and we to consideration of it. Yet millions of Americans felt moral sympathy for the congressman who rose to oppose it.
It will Prussianize America.
It will destroy democracy at home while we're fighting for it abroad.
Involuntary servitude.
A sulky, unwilling, indifferent army.
Conscription is another name for slavery.
But much as we found it in heart and mind to agree with those arguments, still we had to admit, once war burst, that no modern army springs full-grown from behind every rock and tree. Thus we came in World War I to this.
The number is 258.
And thus, from the lessons and experiences of the past, we had a draft, about which historians have been able to say...
Selective service in World War I trod ground never trod before, with concepts which, though not new, had never been tried before on such a scale, and with so bold a trust in the people themselves. It won and held the confidence of the people because it was truly of the people and by the people.
Again, we ask you to mark two things, America. First, time was on our side. An ocean separated us from the field of action, and others were holding the fort while we trained and armed for battle. Second, on November 11, 1918, just as we were geared for war at the highest pitch of the whole 18 months, suddenly the whole effort jolted to a halt.
Hey, what's up? What are we stopping for?
Yeah, what's wrong?
Hey, fellas, it's happened. It's happened.
What?
What's happened?
An armistice. We don't have to go to camp.
What?
They're sending us home. It's all over.
Loaded with inductees were halted en route to army camps and the men brought home for hurried demobilization. With our instinctive devotion to peace, we beat the swords into plowshares almost overnight. And thus, comparatively unarmed, we came to World War II. Again, America, we had time. This time we used it to declare a limited emergency to activate the first peacetime draft in American history.
Well, what I don't see is why I have to go into the army when we're not at war.
The reason became plain enough on December 7th, 1941. And with the attack on Pearl Harbor, Congress shifted the gears of selective service into high, and we got on with the war. And when this one was, as most of us believed, all over, Again, the same thing happened that had happened with them all.
Johnny, 12 points. Mary, 12 points. The baby, 12 points. Now, let me see. With the other points I got, that makes 85. And I'm free. Bless those little chillin'.
So we come to 1951, the year of Korea, the year of MacArthur in the Orient, Eisenhower in Paris, the year of implementation of the North Atlantic Pact. Is it true, as many say, that we have at long last lost forever our old allies of time and distance? After a century and a half behind the relative safety of the Atlantic and Pacific walls, do we finally duplicate the experience of the First French Republic of 1792 with the enemy at our very door? Abroad in the world is a tyranny every bit as vicious as Hitler's and Mussolini's. Should the tyrant choose to strike, the military experts agree, you'll trace the front line on the pickets of your own backyard, for the old security is gone. Gone on the wings of the rocket and the long-range bomber. So your elected deputies, alert to their responsibilities as congressmen and citizens, this week debate the question.
Shall we have universal military service and training? Shall we train every qualified youth in the art of war? Or is the present draft law enough to meet the peril of our times?
It's a question to which all men of good conscience today give deep and sober thought. As to UMT, in Congress one can still hear the warning voices.
The whole abortive scheme is anti-American. Totally foreign.
In a time of hysteria, we should not pass laws which in time of reflection would not be approved.
Turbulent and discontented men of rank are seeking military control over industry, labor, all military establishments, the economy, and the press.
And yet we will also wish to assess the weight of other views. For instance, the testimony of George Marshall on the element of time.
It is not conceivable that we again shall have a great backlog of time in which to pool and organize our manpower resources.
Secretary Marshall, on the political aspect.
This is the time to give convincing proof both to those who hate us and those who look at us as a citadel of liberty that we have adopted a military posture that we can and will maintain as long as it is needed.
The reason?
If we give the other nations of the world any basis for believing that we may again weary of the need for keeping our strength at a high level, the inevitable result will be to encourage those who plot against us and discourage all those who have made common cause with us.
Yet, regardless of the immediate issue, America, of whether or not Congress approves, modifies, or discards the present bill for UMT, there is one voice with which all patriots will agree. It is a voice which speaks to us from the pages of history, the voice of George Washington.
It may be laid down as a primary proposition that every citizen who enjoys the protection of a free government owes not only a portion of his property, but even of his personal services to the defense of it.
Thus, America, we end with the same two men with whom we began. The decision of what we do in this crisis will not be made by our Secretary of Defense or indeed by any group of experts. Thanks to the principles of this democracy we seek to defend, the decision will be made by you. Think well upon it, for upon what you decide hangs not only the survival of this nation, but the fate on this earth of free men everywhere.
The program unit which prepares Living 1951 includes Wade Arnold, executive producer, Edward King, program director, Lou Hazem, writer, and Ben Grauer, narrator. Listen next week when Living 1951, in cooperation with Crusade for Freedom, presents a drama document entitled As Europe Sees Us. Tonight, enjoy delightful Dennis Day and Judy Canova on NBC.